Tickets are on sale now for Spotlight On's next live event, an all-ages show at the Royal Room in Seattle, Washington, on June 22, 2024. Spotlight On: Improvisation in Music and Life will be a unique program of performance and conversation between me and the James Falzone Division Ensemble. Together, we'll explore the nature of improvisation in music and how its principles can be useful in all aspects of life, for musicians and non-musicians alike. Different types of composing in the moment will be demonstrated, interspersed with interludes of discussion, covering what each musician brings to and gets from the experience. Audience members will become participants through a Q&A session that will afford a rare opportunity to gain deeper insight into the art and science of improvisation. Falzone's Division Ensemble is a group of master improvisers that includes James Falzone on clarinet, Ray Larson on trumpet, Wayne Horvitz on piano, Abby Blackwood on bass, and Rocky Martin on drums. For tickets and other information, visit spotlightonpodcast.com or theroyalroomseattle.com. For those of you who cannot join us in person, we would still welcome and appreciate your support in the form of a ticket purchase. If you can, please do, as it would mean the world to us and to this important independent venue. Thanks. Hello and welcome to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host, Lawrence Purrier. Today, the spotlight shines on Berlin-based electronic music composer and performer Heinbach. I've come to view Heinbach as much as an archaeologist or audio specimen collector as he is a musician. While he makes beautiful music and soundscapes, they are often showcase pieces for the devices he works on, which include not only vintage and rare modular synthesizers, but also tape machines, test equipment, and other industrial machinery. A particular highlight of his work is his YouTube channel, where Heinbach brings experimental music techniques and the history of electronic music to a wider audience, frequently displaying how he gets usable sounds out of his forgotten devices. We've included a link to that in the show notes. Heinbach is a fun and creative human, someone I'm grateful to have spent some time with. Enjoy our talk. Thank you so much for making time. I'm so excited to speak with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
There's an overwhelming amount of work that you have put out into the world, whether it's your actual audio recordings or, of course, your YouTube channel, not to mention the scoring work and plugins. I mean, you're just incredibly prolific. I wonder, what is that about? Just the sheer volume of work is amazing.
I find it hard to say no to interesting things. So if there's something interesting that catches my attention, I'm like, yeah, why not? And I basically also transitioned from one line of work into another, because pre-pandemic, I was spending like half the year working for theater. So I composed music for theater plays. And then pandemic hit and that job dried up like nothing. So there was nothing anymore. And at that time, I was super frustrated because it was right when we were doing a play that was supposed to go on stage like the next 2 days after. So that stopped. And it was incredible, frustrating experience. And I felt helpless. So what I did then was I went home and in a day I recorded isolation loops, which was a bunch of sounds from my studio, because I thought to myself, everybody, we are all in this together. Here are some sounds, make something beautiful with that. And I put them up for free or pay what you want. And so many people downloaded those. So many people used those. And some people even paid for that. And I was able to make up some of the lost income from that even, which I hadn't expected. And then all the other things happened, like my YouTube channel. I did a lot of live streams that blew up a lot. And then instrument making happened. And that became a big thing, making all these plugins. Then it just went on. And now I'm in the interesting point where live music is coming back again. So I drove myself a bit into a wall, like over the winter, because I was touring almost every weekend. And then I was doing all the other things that I built up. I released two plugins within like 3 months, and I put out album, and it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work suddenly. And now my job is to make everything a bit more slow. At least I tell myself that. Doesn't work, because now things happen, because there's so many things that are put in motion that are just happening and happening. And I'm not complaining. It's all good. It's just challenging to manage all of that things sometimes, because it's just me and my wife who helps me doing all the bookkeeping and the management in the side.
Yeah.
The good thing is much of this is fun. So much of this is fun. It is fun to dive into these things, to explore the histories of instruments. It is fun to just spend 2 weeks with one single instrument and exploring its depth and record music from that. It's fun to score a movie. It's fun to make music with other people. All of these things are good. So I shouldn't complain.
I love and try to live by the why not philosophy as well. Sometimes my willingness to embark into a situation is undermined by my lack of capability, but I seldom let that stop me. It's because even if some of those things are not fun, they're always interesting.
Yeah, you learn something, and that leads to another thing, and things sometimes lead to things, and I'm happy that things lead to things, because at many points in my life, I felt like there was, like, especially as a musician, that dead ends are appearing, like a band that falls after 5 years, another project that falls after some time, theater jobs that dry up. These feelings of helplessness are horrible when you don't know what's the next thing going to be. So I prefer this situation right now.
As I was preparing for our time together, I have this page of notes with circles and lines and trying to figure out how to map a discussion with you, because there is so much to talk about. But something that I'm very curious about is, when it comes to the equipment that you have assembled and you do assemble, are you out scouting, or is it at a point now where you're sort of known for this and people are calling you constantly? Like, where does one come across a Soviet era 1950s piece of electronics in this day and age?
Oh, I mean, there's many ways things reach me. So I have alerts for things on all the sites. So on classifieds, eBay, blah, 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 blah. And I gotten very good at searching through things. Sometimes I just browse for fun through like business and industrial sections. And then there is something. Then again, yeah, now people know me and then they say, hey, I found this in the Netherlands and I found this in France. I think you should check it out. And I'm like, okay, that's a good idea. Sometimes I just scroll through Reverb and then I find something that I think, oh, I never heard of this. This sounds very interesting. And then if it's cheap, I buy it. If it's not cheap, I try to research it. If it's like anything decent. So sometimes I get contacted by museums even now. Like they say, do you want to have a look at our collection and see what's happening there? Or work with our musical, like mechanical instruments or something like that. It's a mixture. It's a mixture. And where do I find these things? Yeah, they find me, but I also try to find them. And oftentimes these are from people, yeah, basically collectors, usually older men who collected a lot of stuff and then they pass away. And now it's oftentimes that the family contacts me or friends of the family. And then they say, hey, because I've dealt with that myself. It's hard to like get rid or like pass on the collections that your parents have. And I just did that with my family home. So I had all the things and there was all, my father was a professor. So it was full of books. It was like, oh my God, we're never going to get rid of all those books. But then like people came and they were like, four people from this reading circle came and they were just like, I want this. I want this. I want this. And I was so happy that somebody would be like interested in the books. And then from the university, a fellow professor came and took a lot of things. And that felt really, really good to know that these things go somewhere where it's appreciated. And that's similar to, what happens to me. They know I appreciate these things. So either I use them myself or I helped build up a studio in Portugal, in Sonos Copia, where lots of my equipment went. But then also some, I connected them with this one guy who was basically dissolving the collection of his father. And they said, hey, I take some and they can take some. And then they have a studio and I have a studio, so it's like that. So there's oftentimes a story to these things now.
Is your collection, is it living and breathing in that pieces come in, pieces go out, or do you tend to hoard and accumulate?
I don't tend to hoard, I think, because, yeah, that's why I basically like a whole palette of stuff went to Sonash Kopia, because I wanted stuff that I'm not using, I don't want really in my studio, especially not this one. So this is my, I always call it, it's just different places around the house, basically. So it's this is my main studio here and nothing here. Everything must work. Everything has to work. And everything has to serve a function and has to be like on in seconds. And then I can just use it. It has to be immediate, because this is also the place where when I work with directors or other musicians, they come in, they want to try that. Oh, what's that? And it's nothing is more frustrating if it doesn't work. So I try to have this spot always ready. And then I've got another spot, which is in our sort of gallery space. And that's just for like making really calm music, just without pressure, just like two tracks on tape with a few modular things. Then I built a studio in the cellar, which was basically my rehearsal studio for a live session, that a live setup on based on round test equipment and an electronium, like this 1950s accordion that's actually a vacuum tube synthesizer and sounds enormous. It was used by Stockhausen, among others. So that's my live space. All these things work. And everything that I can't get to work anymore, I pass on. Some things like I buy and then I'm going to make a video. Yes. And then I just lose track of making the video. So it's still there sometimes in its original box because I want to film the unboxing and stuff. So I'm like, I can't try it. No, I have to find the time. Like my backlist is enormous and I have so many wonderful things that I want to like make a video about. And that's just another problem of time mostly. So I'm not hoarding. So it's like everything that's not usable has to go because it's not as much as a collection. I call it like instrumentarium. Does that make sense in English? It's like active. All these instruments are active. You can just take them and play with them.
It's interesting because I was watching one of your videos about a piece called the Axel Line Simulator.
Ah, yes.
It was interesting because you made a comment in that piece that I think relates to what you just said, which is you talked about being sucked in by the machine. Like you can't just take it and play with it for a minute and walk away. Like once it starts happening, like you're there and the tones are coming. And all the ways to sort of ride the wave of that the machine is putting out. Part of it goes back to fun, but these sounds are just sort of like warm and enveloping and never ending and so given to exploration.
Yeah, and I feel like that fascination comes also from one belief that I have always is that all the music is out there. It's like all there. Then I just need to find it. So I constantly try to find things in things. And I got this from the singer of my very first band. And because I was giving her basically chords and something, and then she would come up with a melody. And I was like, where do you find the melody? And I was like, she was like, it's just there. It's already there. And I, oh, where is it? And there is, oh, in the overtones, overlapping. There are all the melodies in there. So I started searching for these things that are already there. And I found two very interesting ways for me to find these. And that's trying to break an instrument or trying to go rather to go to its borders. So where the borders, where this thing starts to like not do what it's supposed to. And oftentimes there beautiful things happens. Like there's so many experiences that I had. Like I had one Moog phaser and no Murph filter. It's a filter bank. The last of these big paddles that Bob Moog designed. And I plugged it into some test equipment and that voltage was way too high for it. So the thing just blew open, but it was like, whoa, and it sang wonderful overtones. Oh my God, I found the hidden mode. Turns out the hidden mode was the thing dying. The microcontroller just fried. So the thing was dead after, but it sounded glorious for a moment. Same as on my record, Landfill Totems, where I made a piece called Funktionsverlust, Loss of Function. It was made from three statues that I built from test equipment. And usually these things just go beep in a straight line, but one of them started to go ning 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 ning, and it was wonderful, absolutely glorious tones. And I was like, I need to record this. And I recorded the track and I felt good. I went out, had a coffee, came back after 5 minutes, and then there was a smell. It was a smell of burned electronics and a little bit of smoke still in the corner. And that was the dying song, the swan song of this oscillator, because it just broke. And that's why it sounded so good. The components were basically dying and that instrument sounded really good. So it was actually breaking as I recorded it. And I caught that. And that piece is, it's an important piece for me. So breaking things, and that can be with tape, that can, like finding the edges of where the medium, where the instrument or where the medium, be it tape, be it digital, starts to like show how it's made. It loses everything it tries to be. It just becomes what it is. The other way I try to do this is by using lots of filters, band pass filters, which are just really narrow filters that will select just a tiny band of the audio spectrum. And then I can listen and sweep through things. And what I find there, it feels a bit like science. And especially because working with these things that have all these ginormous dials and we're like state of the art of 1957. And cost as much as a house. Now it's just garbage, a dump. But to find what you can hear is beautiful. And that's not only because you find things in the noise, in the frequencies. You hear the instrument itself. Because every electronic instrument, every filter has its own resonant frequency. So suddenly you're hearing the ripples around the filters singing. That's absolutely wonderful. It's a bit like the act of listening changes what is listened to.
A few more questions about equipment. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to spend all of our time here, but you know, you're a unique resource for some of these answers that I have questions around. It strikes me that the ability to tap into the machines in the way that you do is facilitated by, for lack of a better way to say it, international standards, a plug and a jack, and the actual mechanical interface. Something that is so interesting to me when I watch some of the videos is that they all have the plug. I'm sure there are cases where you come across arcane, bizarre interfaces, but the idea that you could just grab a cable and plug it in, and there's something really incredible about that that I can't quite name. I would imagine you must have thousands of cables.
Yes. And I never have the one that I need in the moment. Never have that one. I was just lugging in like a big old pulse generator and was, oh, okay. It was set it up there. Then I wanted to plug it in and I realized it has a very weird, like three-pronged industrial power plug that's meant to seal in there. So it's like watertight. And I was, I don't have that. And okay, do I want to like tear this thing apart and put this other plug in? I was like, no, don't have time. So I didn't use that. And that's oftentimes, it's a question of like adapters upon adapters upon adapters, which are sources of failure. It's not good to have too many adapters, but it's also very fast. Like right now, much of these things are patched with laboratory cables, like banana cables, like you find in any school laboratory. Really helpful, really easy. Not the best for isolating against like noise. So there's always crosstalk and bleed and stuff like that. And when the cables pass each other, they will interact sometimes.
Oh, sure.
It's
yeah.
Not great in that regard, but it just works because it's fast and you can do a lot quickly. And that's something that I'm also very keen on, to do things quickly and be able to change things. Oftentimes I thought about like how to make things more, for lack of a better word, more professional or standardized, but it's impossible even to decide on one standard for me because there's so many different connectors and so many different things. And to force then these things to be all this one thing doesn't really work. There's pros and cons to all of these things. So I try to keep the lab aspect here, and that feels good. The lab aspect of the whole thing feels very, very healthy in a way that I can still, even though I have like settled on a few choice pieces for this spot, I can still like, okay, take this off, put in a new one instead of having everything racked up and fixed. Standardization is an interesting question because I get so many questions about like audio cables all the time. And one of the biggest questions that always comes up in the subreddit, the Heinbach subreddit, is about German DIN-Kabels, Deutsche Industrienorm, which are the cables that are used on all these Uhur tape machines and stuff like that, or even banana cables. These are cables that are not known to many people, and also because they're a German standard. DIN, it's a bit like, looks like MIDI, but of course then there's all these different ways these five little poles are wired. It's not easy for someone getting into something like this, getting like an Uhr tape machine from Germany, trying to run this in the States. Oh, what do I do with this cable? Where do I find it? I plugged in a MIDI cable. It doesn't work. Only works on one side. It becomes complicated. There's a self-help group about DIN cables on the subreddit.
That's amazing. Country or what territory yields the best stuff? You know, it seems like there's this real, and not just in your work, but it seems like there's this real interesting set of equipment that comes out of the former Soviet bloc or specifically East Germany. Is it just that equipment is foreign to the West, so there's interest in it, or does that area have specifically unique and interesting gear?
They tried to compete with the West and they copied things from the West. But they were always way behind. That's also due to culture politics, especially with synthesizers. Synthesizers were not allowed up until 1980 in East Germany. The first synthesizer that came out in East Germany, the Vemona, Bernd Haller, he worked at Vemona. And when he came to Vemona, he already had the plans for that in the mid-70s. So he could have built it right then. But then the Politburo said, no. This is against social realism. East German musicians don't need synthesizers. He said, okay, fine. And he kept building instruments with like auto-accompany machines with synthesizers for the dance musicians that could afford it. And they would like, because there was a blooming black market for musicians and you could make money all on the side. So they were interested in all this equipment. They tried to buy Western equipment. And if they couldn't, they would have someone commission someone like him to build something for them. So there is always a thing where you have to see that these things were made in spite of a lack of everything, in spite of a lack of microchips, so they had to smuggle in microchips, for example. And there was always a lack of that. And there was always very weird decisions. There were synthesizers like, who would make this first digital synthesizer for East Germany? Okay, it's the company that makes computers. It's not the people that have been designing instruments forever. So they were like, oh, what are we going to do? I've got no idea. Okay, we go to those people. And why do you have? Because that functionary said, we have to make this. And then they had to make it. It's a very top-down way of how things were made. So when you put these things aside from like what was possible in the West to what was possible, what was done in the East is like laughable. The technological level is like always at least 5 years behind. But for us now, I think that's often very interesting because it results in unique tones. Oftentimes in these synths, none of them sound the same because they just use whatever parts they had around. If they had to find very creative ways to make a low-pass filter, for example, on the Polywox, very different to what like you could do easily, all these synthesizers on a chip, basically, where you have got one chip that has all the things that you need on it. That's not how you did it there. It is a bit alien, and that makes it interesting. It is alien to how we are used, how things are made. And I like to see the human ingenuity in the technicians, in the designers, how they made things. And I appreciate some of these things, their tone and their sound. It's very different to anything that you get in the West at that time and now. And that makes it interesting. It's just built differently and it varies widely in sound. It also looks differently. It feels differently. I mean, behind me, there's this big drum machine prototype from Latvia last days before the fall of the Soviet Union. And it's a Frankenstein instrument. It's an absolute monster. You don't know what this is. They obviously tried to look at drum machines from the West, like the TR-808, which was by that time already 10 years old. And they tried to make something similar like that, but it had to be better. So it has a 24-step sequencer. That's something you can sell to the functionaries. Oh, it has more steps. Oh, okay, that's good. That's already better than the West. Yes, with 16 steps. Okay, but same thing with the Vemona. Always 32 steps. Better. We have one advancement over the West. We got more steps. But still, it's an absolute monster. And it at that time, digital drum machines were a thing. So everything sounded very, very hard and punchy. And all the musicians in the Soviet Union or behind the Iron Curtain, they didn't want to play these things. They wanted the Western equipment. They tried to buy, I saw like the ads, they wanted to buy like a DX7. They wanted to have all the good Western stuff. And they didn't want to play Vemona even. Even the people that ran Vemona were very unsure if they would take up the brand again. Because three of these people that made the Vemona brand, they worked at the original Vemona. And at the time, nobody wanted their stuff because it was the thing that they had to play. The musicians had to play this Sandy organ. They had to play this synthesizer. They had to play this drum machine. So they were very doubtful if that was a good choice. In the end, it was a good choice because it is... For us here, it's unique. Yeah. So that was a good choice in the end to revive that brand.
And beautiful to look at from the industrial design point of view. One of your other videos, you were demoing, I hope I say it right, the subharcord.
Yeah, the subharcord. Beautiful. Oh,
it looks like something that would be on a spaceship in a 50s science fiction movie, but so fun. Like just such a cool looking machine.
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, many of the ideas that are in there are from Western instruments. Like they said, okay, so this is from the Trautonium, we take this, and from this Siemens thing, we take this, and now we make it in a new thing. And then the functionary said, oh, there's no such thing as subharmonics. That's not scientifically proven. Is this in the right of like social realism? And then, okay. Got a demo of the functionary, and you say, oh, okay, that's good. Then you can make this. And then he absconded and went over the before the wall came in Berlin. and that was made. It's so interesting because you have this incredible, amazing experimental instrument, but then you have it hampered by a very tiny keyboard, like a very tiny, very unflexible, very badly to play keyboard. It's like you have a Ferrari and then you put in like the motor of a... It's not the motor. What would be like the steering wheel? No, and then you put it
on training or something. Yeah.
Yeah, or training wheels. You put it on training wheels. So it's like, it's like, I can't drive, but it's all the power. It's there. So it's something different.
Is there like a holy grail piece out there that you know exists, but you haven't found yet? Is there something you're just searching for?
I found one of my holy grails now, which is a filter bank that was used like everywhere, like IRCAM. In the Polish studios, that's wonderful. I found that the Brüllinkier filter bank, and I found one from IRCAM. So that was like thrown away there in the 80s or something. That was one of the holy grails. And then there are some Ah, I think that's somewhere in a museum where there's also Tonto, the big synthesizer that was used in the Stevie Wonder production. And I think they have an instrument there that I was really curious to check out, but I just forgot the name and traveled to Canada to check that out. Because also they have a Nova chord and always wanted to play a Nova chord. There's so many things in the end. Right now, I think there's two things in me. So one thing is I have all the instruments that I need to make the music that I want to make. So I don't need to play with that or with this or with that. But then I have got the ambition to have played with everything. So I know I can have informed, what I say is informed. It's not just read knowledge. It's like informed. I've played with this instrument. I've made music with it. So then I know how it works. It's just a deeper level of understanding.
You can add it to your palate. You can say it's not in your palate until you have experienced it.
Yeah. And it's the same. Like it would be so weird to make all these plugins without having like deep knowledge about like all different analog hardware. How could I judge, for example, like tape echoes if I didn't have worked with a space echo? If I had just worked with DynaChords, I could make like, okay, so this is how a DynaChord works. This is how a tape echo sounds. But then you are like, okay, but the space echo, the tape part is interesting, but actually the input preamp. And if it's an older one, that's the stuff that makes it really interesting. That overdrive and the spring reverb with that, that's what's the sound. That makes the sound of it. That's the secret ingredient. It's the tape is just there, but the overdrive makes it interesting. So all these little things that come from knowledge is something that I really want to see and explore. And I have to think about the Holy Grails more. the thing is, every time I think, oh, I'm done. Now this is, it seems to be like there's not so much. Another thing pops up and another thing pops up. And oh, for example, I really would love to play with the real ANS synthesizer, the one in the Soviet Union that you draw on.
Oh, wow.
So there's like somebody in London who makes the Oremix machine. I would love to play with that and explore that in the style of Daphne Oram. Those are things that I would love to work with. I need to work with the Zunti 100 at some point. I just need to figure out in which studio I want to go to work with that, the big one. But there's time.
We'll be back with more Spotlight On right after this break. Other than the podcast itself, the best way to stay in touch with our various goings-on is to be on our mailing list. To sign up, go to spotlightonpodcast.com and click on newsletter. Thanks. And now, back to Spotlight On.
I'm going to ask you to maybe break it down into simple terms for our audience. Could you talk about what it means to make a plugin? What is it that you're actually doing when you're commissioned to make a plugin?
The thing is, I'll talk about the process with AudioThing, for example. AudioThing, Carlo, he just asked me after he saw a video on my Soviet VIA recorder, hey, that's a nice thing. Shall we make a plugin out of it? He said, yeah, okay, cool. Let's do it. What that involved was me doing measurements upon measurements upon measurements, like throwing everything at this instrument, at this recorder, to see if there's anything we can learn from sweeping it, from putting in noise, from putting in little pulses. You try to see like all the things that make this machine tick. Then you end up with basically your fingerprint of the machine. And then you should be able to open this in another program, and then it should give you like representation of the thing. That's called convolution. With something like this, that didn't work because this requires very pristine, very clean environment. And these machines, this VIA recorder just sounds too dirty. So there was just all this noise. So then we said, okay, we need to black box this. What's actually happening when you record a signal on a wire? I didn't go into the physical side of it. I went into the listening side of it. And the listener thought, okay, when this input at this frequency hits this level, this happens. How can I replicate that? And I basically built a whole patch in my head of things that happen at certain frequencies, when that happens, and then, and then, and then. That becomes a feedback system where everything becomes alive. These ideas that I had, I gave them to Carlo from AudioThing. I said, look, this is when this and this. And he said, oh, okay. Then he gave me his model that he made from that. And then I got to tweak all the different settings until I couldn't hear a difference anymore between the original and the plugin. And that's one of those things. It's a form of figuring these things out, not from the technical standpoint for me, but from the musical standpoint. How does it sound? Why does it sound like that? That's exciting to me. And then there's other things, like we had the glorious idea to model the gong amp, which is a resonator made in the 1930s. And that resonator is basically a gong with an exciter. So you can plug in your guitar, and then instead of loudspeaker, a gong will resonate. Sounds absolutely beautiful. Built by Aunt Martineau. Wonderful. In the 1930s, a very old invention. So I captured the impulses, used different microphones, made processing with it. And that sounded really good. But then to make it alive, we needed to do a bunch of things. And I had then the idea, hey, I like to prepare things. I like to put on cymbals. I like to put in like chains, like every experimental drummer at every art gallery show ever. I put on chains. And suddenly we had a week of work just figuring out how a chain bounces on a gong. It's like that was such a fun, but also like infuriating work, because you go into physical modeling and that single chain, or it's two different chains now, that took so much time to figure out that it sounds alive. That's another thing. You have to think about people. Not everybody has the most high-end laptop or computer, and they want to buy it and they want to use it. And it's easy to make things that are incredibly good sounding when you have got an incredible amount of processing power. That's not how it works. Then you get very angry customers who say, your plugin, just put one on. It's 70% of my company. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you need to like find a balance between processing power, what you can do there, and sound. Wow. And then, of course, you take it further. That's because in digital, you can do unreal things that you can't do with the original. And then the real fun part starts. That's like to figure out what can be the next thing. What can be the next thing that this can do that the original couldn't do? This is like when I do work with audio thing. Then I also did a plugin called Fluss, which was more generally based on, it's a granular synthesizer. A granular synthesizer takes sounds that, instead of like thinking that all sounds are waves or frequencies, well, it's not waves, it's little particles. And when you put enough of these particles together, the sound happens. That's the idea behind granular. It was pioneered by Yanis Xenakis, a Greek composer who was shot in the face by a Sherman tank in the Greek War for Independence. That experience really stayed with him. And he tried to figure out ways how to put that to music. And one of the ways he wanted to put this to music was granular synthesis. To develop sound systems where particles can fly through the air, be at that spot there, go over there, crash incredible motions of sound, same as you get on the demonstration when the tanks roll in. And I was so fascinated by that idea that I pictured to Bram, with whom I did Fluss, I want to make something where you have these sounds like an interface, because this is going to be on the iPad, which is the perfect, wonderful interface for like letting things fly through space. And then you take this particles of sound and you smash them there and then you crash them in this. And I was very animated, like, he looked at me like, and I heard nothing for half a year. I thought, okay, this is too much. I overtext like what this idea is like. And then after half a year, he came, look, I made something. And he had taken all these ideas and made them into something that's actually easily playable for people. So, and fun and easy. I was like, my God, this is fantastic. And then we tweaked onwards. So, but it all came from this big, come on, let's smash things together. And yeah.
When you're communicating with the person who's doing the programming of the plugin, what language are you communicating in? Are you speaking in terms of frequencies? Like when you mentioned the Soviet wire recorder and you said you had to listen to it to understand like what it was doing. What are you then saying to your partner? It is resonating at this frequency and it sounds like it has this type of compression. Like
One thing that really helps is that I spend a lot of time learning modular. So I learn how to build my own synthesizers with just a screwdriver and my wallet by putting all these different little modules in a box and then making patch connections. And that helped me think about sound design in a much more open and much different way. So then I can say, if we put an envelope follower at 2 kilohertz, and that envelope follower triggers a ring modulator that resonates at 300 hertz, then you will get the same effect that the wire recorder introduces. And that's, okay. So that, and then there comes another, and then you add, okay, and then we try this, and then it's all about, and then he sets like the parameters. And there's like, when you would see like the development version of these things, there's so many parameters that are now hidden. There are now maybe just one knob that does many things, but many of these things are hidden because they're basically the core of what makes the sound of this instrument.
Right. They're not the user variables.
Exactly. And because that's the sound of the thing. That's the same as when you are like, you know, when you're cooking, the ingredients at some point, like they mesh so well that you don't know what is that, but you can still see, there's potatoes, there's peas, and then there's this sauce. But what is the sauce? And the sauce is, that's where the thing comes from with the sauce. Okay. The sauce is something that's a multitude of components that you can't tell apart anymore. It just becomes good as a sauce, as a one thing.
I guess the project with the plugins and the virtual instruments seems to me about taking these things that you have found, that you have discovered, that you have repurposed and brought into the modern world, and making them available to all creators. It would seem that could be an endless project, given that there's endless hardware that you've uncovered.
There is. There's so many projects that we have that we are parallel working on. Next one is going to be an actually free one. It's also, but it's not going to be a particular thing. It's going to be very special. And we just had a talk today about what it's going to be. And this is something that we've been working on for like, I think it's almost 2 years now, 1.5 years. And it involved a lot of travel. It's one of the biggest things I've worked on so far.
Wow.
The other purpose is even more educational. So it's about telling about a certain technique that was used in experimental music. And it required a lot of convincing a lot of people to let us do this thing, to allow us to do this thing. That's the big one for hopefully April.
Okay, we'll keep an eye out for that.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about your work as a composer, and specifically when it comes to scoring. Are you a sit at the piano with the blank sheet music and write out the notation type composer, or... what's your modality? What's your methodology?
I go into the studio and I start turning things on, and then I start playing usually. So that helps a lot. But if we're talking about a movie and or theater or something, it's already like it's easy because there is something. There's not a blank sheet. There's already the movie, you know, there's already like a task. It's so much easier almost than making music on your own because you already have the strong partner there. It's like the movie and then you need to do something. And it just depends what's the taste of the directors, what are they looking for, and what works for the film. So you have to find that balance. So what's theirs, what's yours, and then you have to make strong suggestions that are something that are good, that work, and find a way to play with the film, with the vision of the director, and with your own vision for the film. And oftentimes what I found, this involves a lot of talking and a lot of talking and a lot of hanging out too late in bars and arguing and thinking. And then like with the movie that just comes out now on the 15th of February called Shock. I really understood what they wanted. They came here, we worked together, and then we went for food. Then we went into a bar, and at 4:30 or something, I really understood what they wanted, and I went in the studio like with very little sleep, and I started recording a big piece for the ending, which was based on like a bit of a fugue theme, but in the vein of an Ennio Morricone shootout that totally contrasted. It absolutely contrasted the scene, because the scene is a very documentarily filmed shootout. It's no glorification of violence. It's just very, like you would film it, somebody like just walking behind it, that it's very almost like war reporter style. But then to have the music that completely does the opposite and makes it to something like from a Western, from a Italo Western, that was so good. That felt so good. And then they were like, yes. And I was like, yes. So, but I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't known them, because that's where the music starts to tell something that seems to be different from the picture, you know? And that's something you need to communicate, where the music takes narration. It does narration. And that's something you have to really communicate, because it's not invisible in that point. It becomes big.
I think it's an underappreciated part of the collaborative nature of film, which is everything around sound design. To watch how audio gets mixed and how sound design gets added, and then ultimately how music gets added, you can really watch the picture come alive in a way that's incredibly exciting, but so taken for granted by the viewer.
Yeah, it's only noticeable when it's bad. When you got bad sound design, like, oh my God, it feels jarring. So if it's jarring, but when you've got good sound design, most people don't notice, but sometimes they do. Like in that movie, people notice because there's ab 18 in Germany. So you have to be over the age of 18 to watch it. I don't know what that rating is.
R, restricted.
Rated R, restricted. So there's a lot of scenes that are very violent, and the sound helps to translate the violence. Yeah. But it's also how you say it's doctor's violence sometimes, you know, so like someone like gets a tooth pulled, and that's shown very clearly. Okay. Yes. Well, it's very good. It's a lot of practical effects. It's a genre movie. It's a film noir. So very good. I'm so happy to have worked with that.
What other art and media influences you, or do you consume? Do you read? Are you interested in film? Like, what else do you take in that you incorporate into your mind?
Lots of things. I try to find lots of things. I read a lot. I read tons. I love reading. I read two things. Oftentimes in the morning and in the evening, I read for pleasure. And sometimes when I've got extra time in the afternoon, I read like more things that can give me more knowledge, help me research, basically. Then I do watch a lot of YouTube. I do watch a lot of YouTube because there's many fantastic things that people like, especially if you're going to the fringy subjects. So where you can discover so many things. There was a very curious story about a question why a certain keyboard from the late 90s was so expensive still. And I went into the research trip and found out that in Peru, there's so many people like using this, making music with it. And they were responsible for keeping the prices on these old keyboards high, but they had the whole culture about a whole like YouTube culture about like shootouts of that particular sound with that keyboard. It was really interesting to go into. But then I like to go to shows. I like to go as much as I can. It's a bit hard with two kids and touring myself. So I like to watch music, and I like to go to art galleries, and I like to go to museums. That helps a lot. Yeah, I do watch films too. Like, with two kids, it's another commitment. So it's all these things.
Yeah.
And I try to take in things because, yeah, that makes you grow. But it's in many things, I'm still also like drawing still from what I learned during my studies. So I studied English and musicology, and many of the things that I learned there still help me. So I've got a good basis in the theory of music, and that really helps. So to have that as a foundation. And I consume a lot of instruments. That's definitely, definitely one of the main things that I consume.
Yeah.
And and the best thing, nature. That's definitely, that's very typically German of me, but I like to just go out, look at nature, and that helps me. That helps me a lot to calm my mind. And suddenly ideas just start popping. I sometimes, when I have to script a video, I script it while jogging because I'm like, all the ideas, suddenly it's free. I'm just in the open sky and beautiful.
Yeah. The sort of meditative power of, or contemplative power of a walk or just being outside. Yeah. And for someone, that's such an interesting contrast with someone who's so deeply technological or technically capable, I would imagine becomes even more important because you're surrounded with sort of the hum and electricity and energy and waves constantly.
It's super, super helpful. I mean, I come from the Black Forest and I always had the mountains and forest around me, or like vineyards, lots of vineyards everywhere. And like two castles, I could look, looked at my childhood home and there was like one castle there and one castle there, ruins. That influenced me a lot. And in Berlin, there's not so much like that. It's a different thing. So I'm just lucky that there's the old shut down Tempelhof airfield. So that's where I often go if I want to, like, it's a bit like going to the sea because there's just a big empty space that you can walk on. It's a treasure for the city.
What's the significance or the closest English approximation to your name?
Hainbach. So Hain is a grove of trees, a small grove of trees. And then Bach is a little river. So it's a small grove of trees by a small river. It's my mother's maiden name.
Oh, beautiful. Given all of the things that you do and the avenues that you pursue, how do you self-identify? What are you primarily?
Musician first, and then all the other things. So I accept all the labels like YouTube personality or video persona, which was a fun one. Then software developer, because that's something. Because I had to get a life insurance because we bought a house. And the life insurance that you have to take for the mortgage was cheaper when I was a software developer than as a musician or as a composer. So I said, I'm a software developer now. So that saved me six bucks a month.
That's so incredible. I thought I would have assumed composers lived a long life, but
no, composers same as musician. Like it's they looked at the statistics and they said, no, not good.
That's an incredible piece of trivia. I love knowing that. Thank you.
Yeah.
One thing I have to say before you go is that the YouTube channel, it's incredible. The library that is there, first of all, your personality, your video personality definitely comes through and it radiates sort of the things you talked about, the joy, the curiosity, the wonder with the equipment and the sounds that come out. I mean, it's just they're beautiful videos to watch. And a wealth of information. The material is just, it's so exciting. In a world where I don't need more material to consume, I was like, it makes you want to watch every video. Like they're so fun and engaging. I just wanted you to know, I really enjoy what you're doing.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. It is a lot of work, especially the editing. So sometimes I'm like, oh, no, I don't. But one thing that I learned, because I started this with a very rigid mindset. So I would do like 2 videos every week.
Oh, wow.
That was when I transitioned from just posting music, because I had gained like 10,000 subscribers by just posting my music. So that was the thing. And then so many questions came that I thought, okay, I'm just going to start answering these questions on video instead of writing like long essays in the comments. And then I said, okay, cool. So people like these too. It's horrible to make. And I can't watch my early videos because I'm like, I'm Heinbach. And this is a video on the Vogtec Omnicord. When you press that, it's like horrible. I'm so stiff and I don't even look at the camera right because I look at the tiny screen next to it. And I don't know where my voice is. Sometimes it's here. I don't know because microphones, so then I talk deep. And then my voice is here. It's very, I didn't know what I was even on the camera. And it took took some time to find the personality, the video personality. Then I did like 2 videos every week. And that was good for the growth of the channel because that was at the time when that was especially rewarded. Just putting out stuff. Continuous. But then I realized this pace is unsustainable, completely unsustainable. I need something more chill. And now I've worked out, I'd rather post less, but more, you know, less constant, but better. So I try to make better videos, also not to waste anybody's time. So I'd rather make the videos just better and post it. And what easily makes the videos better is when I enjoy making them. So when I'm too tired to go at the camera and talk, then don't, because I did that. I did videos where I was tired, really tired. And then I still, of course, I have to do it. And then I realized, no, this is not good. This is not good tape. This doesn't work. It doesn't resonate as well because, yeah, it translates that I'm not an actor. I'm just me. So then I decided I'm just going to make the videos when I really feel it. Luckily, that's most of the time. So I really enjoy making this. The one thing that I really don't enjoy is that I sometimes now I've got like I've got 8 different videos that I'm working on in parallel and I need to like finish. And sometimes I just want to be like, what's this box? Let's make this box. And sometimes I do that, which is next video. It's just that. I say, okay, I'm going to stop all the schedule. Just make this. And that's fun. Oh my God. It's fun making these videos.
You know, it's really interesting what you say there, though, because I do understand that there is this world where there are very successful people, whether it's on YouTube or TikTok or whatever the current platform is, where the algorithm and the platform has its best practices that it's telling you to do, whether it's post twice a week or do something every 2 hours, whatever it is. And there are people that can do that, have mastered that, and are successful as a result. I would consider those people content creators. Mm-hmm. And I don't demean them or look down on them, but they are riding that wave. But when you have a creative person who is just using the platform to express what they have to say when they have something to say, that's a different form of success. That's something that resonates a little more for me. Not that I can't enjoy viral content or whatever, but there's a difference.
That's very interesting you put it like that. That's actually pretty freeing. Thank you for this. This is a good point. This is actually a good point. Okay. And one thing that I realized, because when all of this, I mean, I've got many friends that do YouTube videos now, because I basically met most of the people that are doing, that are in this space of creating with instruments and electronic music, and everyone is different. Everyone does their own thing. Everybody is their very own person. So there's not a competition. It's going on. It's just everybody's so different, but there's still not a lot of experience in how this whole thing goes, because this thing, this being a video personality, is still very new. It's still something that we're still seeing how it is, and it constantly keeps changing. This year, it felt like it was the time when everybody said, I'm not going to do this anymore, because I think everybody in January was like, no, I can't do this anymore. And I think that's everybody, that's the post-COVID hangover that everybody has, where everybody like, oh my God, everything's blowing up. Everybody's watching. Everybody's at home. And now, no, not so much anymore, because of course, everybody is busy again. So that was a boost that then goes down. That was really interesting to see all of that right at the point when I was like, I just want to make videos, and I shot two. And I was like, it's fun. And everybody, you're all leaving? Okay. I'm still here.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I'm going to look forward to trying to watch the entire library of videos at some point.
Thanks for having me. This was a lovely conversation.
Thank you so much, Heinbach. As always, thank you for listening to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host and executive producer, Lawrence Purrier. We're produced and edited by Michael Donaldson, with theme music by Q Burns' Abstract Message. If you'd like to support our work, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. After you do that, visit us online at spotlightonpodcast.com. There you'll find our free episode archive, weekly postings on our official blog, and a ton more. Thanks for listening, be safe, and stay in touch.